she said, subverting the religions and governments of his enemies, setting nation against nation. None would have kept him in power for more than a decade had he not possessed the genius to steal and to set at the centre of his empire the greatest symbol of power in the Imagica. The pivot was Hapexamendios's marker, and the fact that the unbeheld had allowed the architect of Isordorex to even touch, much less move his pylon, was for many proof that however much they might despise the autarch, he was touched by divinity, and could never be toppled. What powers it had conferred on its possessor even she didn't know.
"Sometimes," she said, "when he was high on Crouchy, he'd talk about the pivot as though he was married to it, and he was the wife. Even when we made love, he'd talk that way. He'd say it was in him the way he was in me. He'd always deny it afterward, of course, but it was in his mind always. It's in every man's mind."
Jude doubted this and said so.
"But they so want to be possessed," Quasar replied. "They want some holy spirit inside them. You listen to their prayers." "That's not something I hear very often." "You will when the smoke clears," Quasar replied. "They'll be afraid once they realize the autarch's gone. They may have hated him, but they'll hate his absence more."
"If they're afraid, they'll be dangerous," Jude said, realizing as she spoke how well these sentiments might have come from Clara Leash's mouth.
"They won't be devout."
Concupiscentia halted before Quasar could take up her account afresh, and began to murmur a little prayer of her own.
"Are we here?" Quasar asked.
The creature broke the rhythm of her entreaty to tell her mistress that they were. There was nothing remarkable about the door in front of them, or the staircases that wound out of sight to either side of it. All were monumental, and therefore commonplace. They'd passed through dozens of portals like this as they'd made their way through the place's cooling belly. But Concupiscentia was plainly in terror of it, or rather, of what lay on the other side.
"Are we near the pivot?" Jude said. "The tower's directly above us," Quasar replied. "That's not where we're going?" "No. The pivot would probably kill us both. But there's a chamber below the tower where the messages the pivot collects drain away. I've spied there often, though he never knew it."
Jude let go of Quasar's arm and went to the door, keeping to herself the irritation she felt at being denied the tower itself. She wanted to see this power, which had reputedly been shaped and planted by God himself. Quasar had talked of it as lethal, and perhaps it was, but how was anyone to know until they tested themselves against it? Perhaps its reputation was the autarch's invention, his way of keeping its gifts for himself. Under its aegis, he'd prospered, no doubt of that. What might others do if they had its blessing conferred upon them? Turn night to day? She turned the handle and pushed open the door. Sour and chilly air issued from the darkened space beyond. Jude summoned Concupiscentia to her side, took the lamp from the creature and held it high. Ahead lay a small inclined corridor, its walls almost burnished.
"Do I wait here, lady?" Concupiscentia asked. "Give me whatever you brought to eat," Quasar replied, "and stay outside the door. If you hear or see anybody, I want you to come and find us. I know you don't like to go in there, but you must be brave. Understand me, dearling?"
"I understand, lady,"
Concupiscentia replied, handing to her mistress the bundle and the bottle she'd carried with her. Thus laden, Quasar took Jude's arm and they stepped into the passage. One part of the fortress's machine was still operational, it seemed, because as soon as they closed the door after them, a circuit, broken as long as the door stood wide, was completed, and the air began to vibrate against their skin. Vibrate and whisper.
"Here they are," Quasar said. "The intimations."
That was too civilized a word for this sound, Jude thought. The passageway was filled with a quiet commotion, like snatches from 1,000 radio stations, all incomprehensible, coming and going as the dial was flipped and flipped again. Jude raised the lamp to see how much farther they had to travel. The passageway ended 10 yards ahead, but with every yard they covered, the din increased, not in volume but in complexity, as new stations were added to the number the walls were already tuned into. None of it was music. There were multitudes of voices raised as a single sound, and there were solitary howls. There were sobs and shouts, and words spoken like a recitation.
"What is this noise?" Jude asked.
"The pivot hears every piece of magic in the dominions, every invocation, every confession, every dying oath. This is the unbeheld's way of knowing what gods are being worshipped besides him, and what goddesses too."
"He spies on deathbeds," Jude said,
more than faintly disgusted by the thought.
"On every place where a mortal thing speaks to the divine, whether the divinity exists or not, whether the prayer's answered or not, he's there."
"Here too," Jude said.
"Not unless you start praying,"
Quasar said.
"I won't."
They were at the end of the passage, and the air was busier than ever, colder too. The lamp's light illuminated a room shaped like a colander, maybe 20 feet across, its curved walls as polished as those of the passage. In the floor was a grill, like a gutter beneath a butcher's table, through which the detritus of prayers ripped from the hearts of those in grief, or washed up in tears of joy, ran off into the mountain upon which Isorderex was built. It was difficult for Jude to grasp the notion of prayer as a solid thing, a kind of matter to be gathered, analysed, and sluiced away, but she knew her incomprehension was a consequence of living in a world out of love with transformation. There was nothing so solid that it couldn't be abstracted, nothing so ethereal that it couldn't find a place in the material world. Prayer might be substance after a time, and thought, which she'd believed skullbound until the dream of the blue stone, fly like a bright-eyed bird, seeing the world remote from its sender. A flea might unravel flesh if wise to its code, and flesh in its turn move between worlds as a picture drawn in the mind of passage. All these mysteries were, she knew, part of a single system, if she could only grasp it. One form becoming another, and another, and another, in a glorious tapestry of transformations, the sum of which was being itself. It was no accident that she embraced that possibility here. Though the sounds that filled the room were incomprehensible as yet, their purpose was known to her, and it raised the ambition of her thoughts. She let go of Quasar's arm and walked into the middle of the room, setting the lamp down beside the grill in the floor. They'd come here for a specific reason, and she knew she had to hold fast to that. Otherwise her thoughts would be carried away on the swell of sound.
"How do we make sense of it?" she said to Quasar.
"It takes time," her sister replied, "even for me. But I marked the compass points on the walls. Do you see?"
She did. Crude marks scratched in the surface sheen.
"The erasure is north-northwest of here. We can narrow the possibilities a little by turning in that direction."
She extended her arms like a haunting spirit.
"Will you lead me to the middle?" she said.
Jude obliged, and they both turned in the direction of the erasure. As far as Jude was concerned, doing so did little good. The din continued in all its complexity, but Quasar dropped her hands and listened intently, moving her head slightly from side to side as she did so. Several minutes passed, Jude keeping her silence for fear an inquiry would break her sister's concentration, and was rewarded for her diligence, finally, with some murmured words.
"They're praying to the Madonna," Quasar said.
"Who are?"
"Dirthers, out at the erasure. They're giving thanks for their deliverance, and asking for the souls of the dead to be received into paradise."
She fell silent again for a time, and now, with some clue as to what she had to listen for, Jude attempted to sort through the intimations that filled her head. But although she was refining her focus, and could now snatch words and phrases out of the confusion, she couldn't hold that focus long enough to make any sense of what she heard. After a time, Quasar's body relaxed, and she shrugged.
"There's just glimpses now," she said. "I think they're finding bodies. I hear little sobs of prayers and little oaths."
"Do you know what happened?"
"This was some time ago," Quasar said.
The pivots had these prayers for several hours. But it was something calamitous, that's certain, she said. I think there are a lot of casualties.
It's as if what happened in his Orderex is spreading, Jude said.
Maybe it is, Quasar said.
Do you want to sit down and eat?
In here?
Why not? I find it very soothing.
Reaching for Jude to help her, Quasar squatted down.
You get used to it after a time. Maybe a little addicted. Speaking of which, where's the food?
Jude put the bundle into Quasar's outstretched hands.
I hope the child packed Crouchy.
Her fingers were strong and, having scarred the surface of the bundle, dug deep, passing the contents over to Jude one by one. There was fruit. There were three loaves of black bread. There was some meat and, the finding enough to bring a gleeful yelp from Quasar, a small parcel which she did not pass over to Jude but put to her nose.
Bright thing, Quasar said. She knows what I need.
Is it some kind of drug? Jude said, laying down the food.
I don't want you taking it. I need you here, not drifting off. Are you trying to forbid me my pleasure after the way you dreamed on my pillows?
Quasar said.
Oh, yes, I heard your gasping and your groaning. Who were you imagining?
That's my business.
And this is mine,
Quasar replied, discarding the tissue in which concupiscentia had fastidiously wrapped the Crouchy. It looked appetizing, like a cube of fudge.
When you've got no addiction of your own, sister, then you can moralize,
Quasar said.
I won't listen, but you can moralize.
With that, she put the whole of the Crouchy into her mouth, chewing on it contentedly. Jude, meanwhile, sought more conventional sustenance, choosing among the various fruits one that resembled a diminutive pineapple, and peeling it to discover it was just that, its juice tart, but its meat tasty. That eaten, she went on to the bread and slivers of meat, her hunger so stimulated by the first few bites that she steadily devoured the lot, washing it down with bitter water from the bottle. The fall of prayers that had seemed so insistent when she'd first entered the chamber could not compete with the more immediate sensations of fruit, bread, meat, and water. The din became a background burble which she scarcely thought about until she'd finished her meal. By that time, the Crouchy was clearly working in Quasar's system. She was swaying back and forth as though in the arms of some invisible tide.
Can you hear me?
Jude asked her.
She took a while to reply.
Why don't you join me? She said. Kiss me, and we can share the Crouchy, mouth to mouth, mind to mind. I don't want to kiss you.
Why not?
Do you hate yourself too much to make love?
She smiled to herself, amused by the perverse logic of this.
Have you ever made love to a woman? Not that I remember. I have. At the Bastion. It was better than being with a man.
She reached out towards Jude and found her hand with the accuracy of one sighted.
You're cold, she said.
No, you're hot, Jude replied, moving to break the contact.
You know what air makes this place so cold, sister, Quasar said. It's the pit beneath the city, where the fake Redeemer went.
Jude looked down at the grill and shuddered. The dead were down there somewhere.
You're cold like the dead are cold, Quasar went on. I see heart.
All this she said in a sing-song voice, to the rhythm of her rocking.
Poor sister, to be dead already.
I don't want to hear any more of this, Jude said.
She'd preserved her equanimity so far, but Quasar's fugue talk was beginning to irritate her.
If you don't stop, she said quietly, I'm going to leave you here. Don't do that. Quasar replied, I want you to stay and make love to me. I've told you, mouth to mouth, mind to mind. You're talking in circles. That's the way the world was made, she said, joined together, round and round.
She put her hand to her mouth as if to cover it, then smiled with almost fiendish glee.
There's no way in, and there's no way out. That's what the goddess says.
When we make love, we go round and round.
She searched for Jude a second time with the same unerring ease, and a second time Jude withdrew her hand, realizing as she did so that this repetition was part of her sister's egocentric game, a sealed system of mirrored flesh moving round and round. Was that truly how the world was made? If so, it sounded like a trap, and she wanted her mind out of it there and then.
"I can't stay in here," she said to Quasar. "You'll come back," her sister replied. "Yes, in a while."
The answer was more repetition.
"You'll come back."
This time Jude didn't bother replying, but crossed to the passageway and climbed back up to the door. Concupiscentia was still waiting on the other side, asleep now, her form delineated by the first signs of dawn through the window on the sill of which she rested. The fact that day was breaking surprised Jude. She'd assumed that there were several hours yet before the comet reared its burning head. She was obviously more disoriented than she'd thought. The time she'd spent in the room with Quasar, listening to the prayers, eating and arguing, not minutes but hours. She went to the window and looked down at the dim courtyards. Birds stirred on a ledge somewhere below her and rose suddenly, heading into the brightening sky, taking her eye with them up towards the tower. Quasar had been unequivocal about the dangers of venturing there, but for all her talk of love between women, wasn't she still in thrall to the mythologies of the man who'd made her queen of his Ordrex, and therefore bound to believe that the places he kept her from would do her harm? There was no better time to challenge that mythology than now, Jude thought, with a new day beginning, and the power that had uprooted the pivot and raised such walls around it gone. She went to the stairs and started to climb. After a few steps, their curve took her into utter darkness, and she was obliged to ascend as blind as the sister she'd left below, her palm flat against the cold wall. But after maybe 30 stairs, her outstretched arm encountered a door, so heavy she first assumed it to be locked. It required all her strength to open, but her effort was well rewarded. On the other side was a passageway lighter than the staircase she'd climbed, though still gloomy enough to limit her sight to less than 10 yards. Hugging the wall, she advanced with great caution, her route bringing her to the corner of a corridor, the door that had once sealed it off from the chamber at its end blown from its hinges and lying, fractured and twisted, on the tiled floor beyond. She paused here in order to listen for any sign of the wrecker's presence. There was none, so she moved on past the place, her gaze drawn to a flight of stairs that led up to her left. Forsaking the passageway, she began a second ascent, this one also leading into darkness until she rounded a corner and a sliver of light descended to meet her. Its source was the door at the summit of the stairs, which stood slightly ajar. Again she halted a moment. Though there was no overt indication of power here, the atmosphere was almost tranquil. She knew that the force she'd come to confront was undoubtedly waiting in its silo at the top of the stairs, and more than likely sentient. She didn't discount the possibility that this hush was contrived to soothe her, and the light sent to coax. But if it wanted her up there, it must have a reason. And if it didn't, if it was as lifeless as the stone underfoot, she had nothing to lose.
"Let's see what you're made of," she said aloud.
The challenge delivered at least as much to herself as the unbeheld's pivot. And so saying, she went to the door. 2. Though there were undoubtedly more direct routes to the pivot tower than the one he'd taken with Nicetomas, Gentle decided to go the way he half remembered, rather than attempt a shortcut and find himself lost in the labyrinth. He parted company with Flaccus, Dado, Saishai, and Litter at the Gate of Saints, and began his climb through the palace, checking on his position relative to the pivot tower from every window. Dawn was in the offing. Birds rose, singing from their nests beneath the colonnades, and swooped over the courtyards, indifferent to the bitter smoke that passed for mist this morning. Another day was imminent, and his system was badly in need of sleep. He'd dozed a little on the journey from the erasure, but the effect had been cosmetic. There was a fatigue in his marrow which would bring him to his knees very soon now, and the knowledge of that made him eager to complete the day's business as quickly as possible. He'd come back here for 2 reasons. First, to finish the task Pi's appearance and wounding had diverted him from, the pursuit and execution of Sartori. Second, whether he found his doppelganger here or not, to make his way back to the fifth, where Sartori had talked of founding his new Isordrex. It wouldn't be difficult to get home, he knew, now that he was alive to his capacities as a maestro. Even without the mistiff to point the way, he'd be able to dig from memory the means to pass between dominions. But first, Sartori. Though 2 days had passed since he'd let the autarch slip, he nursed the hope that his other would still be haunting his palace. After all, removal from this self-made womb where his smallest word had been law and his tiniest deed worshipful would be painful. He'd linger a while, surely. And if he was going to linger anywhere, it would be close to the object of power that had made him the undisputed master of the reconciled dominions, the Pivot. He was just beginning to curse himself for losing his way when he came upon the spot where Pi had fallen. He recognized it instantly, as he did the distant door that led into the tower. He allowed himself a moment of meditation at the spot where he'd cradled Pi, but it wasn't their fond exchanges here that filled his head. It was the mistiff's last words, uttered in anguish as the force behind the erasure claimed it. "Sartori," Pi had said, "find him. He knows." Whatever knowledge Sartori possessed, and gentle guessed it would concern plots laid against the reconciliation, he, gentle, was ready to do whatever was required in order to squeeze this information from his other before he delivered the coup de grace. There were no moral niceties here. If he had to break every bone in Sartori's body, it would be a little hurt set beside the crimes he'd committed as autarch, and gentle would perform such duties gladly. Thought of torture and the pleasure he'd taken it had tempted him from his meditation entirely, and he gave up on his pursuit of equilibrium. Venom swilling in his belly, he headed down the corridor, through the door, and into the tower. Though the comet was climbing towards mid-morning, very little of its light gained access to the tower, but those few beams that did creep in showed him empty passageways in all directions. He still advanced with caution. This was a maze of chambers, any one of which might conceal his enemy. Fatigue left him less light-footed than he'd have liked, but he reached the stairs that curled up towards the silo itself, without his stumblings attracting any attention, and began to climb. The door at the top had been opened, he remembered, with the key of Sartori's thumb, and he'd have to repeat the fate himself in order to enter. That was no great challenge. They had the same thumbs. To the tiniest whirl. As it was, he needed no fate. The door was open wide, and somebody was moving about inside. Gentle halted 10 steps from the threshold and drew breath. He'd need to incapacitate his other quickly if he was to prevent retaliation, a pneuma to take off his right hand, another for his left. Breath readied, he climbed swiftly to the top of the stairs and stepped into the tower. His enemy was standing beneath the pivot, arms raised, reaching for the stone. He was all in shadow, but Gentle caught the motion of his head as he turned towards the door, and before the other could lower his arms in defence, Gentle had his fist to his mouth, the breath rising in his throat. As it filled his palm, his enemy spoke. But the voice, when it came, was not his own, as he'd expected, but that of a woman. Realising his error, he clamped his fist around the pneuma to quench it. But the power he'd unleashed wasn't about to be cheated of its quarry. It broke from between his fingers, its force fragmented, but no less eager for that. The pieces flew off around the silo, some darting up the sides of the pivot, others entering its shadow and extinguished there. The woman cried out in alarm and retreated from her attacker, backing against the opposite wall. There the light found her perfection. It was Judith. Or at least it seemed to be. He'd seen this face in Isordrex once already, and been mistaken.
"Gentle," she said, "is that you?"
It sounded like her, too, but then hadn't that been his promise to Roxburgh, that he'd fashion a copy indistinguishable from the original?
"It's me," she said. "It's Jude."
Now he began to believe it was, for there was more proof in that last syllable than sight could ever supply. Nobody in her circle of admirers, besides Gentle, had ever called her Jude. Judy, sometimes. Juju, even, but never Jude. That was his diminution, and to his certain knowledge she'd never suffered another to use it. He repeated it now, his hand dropping from his mouth as he spoke, and, seeing the smile spread across his face, she ventured back towards him, returning into the shadow of the pivot as he came to meet her. The move saved her life. Seconds after she left the wall, a slab of rock blasted from the heights of the silo by the Pneuma fell on the spot where she'd stood. It initiated a hard, lethal rain, shards of stone falling on all sides. There was safety in the shelter of the pivot, however, and there they met and kissed and embraced as though they'd been parted a lifetime, not weeks, which in a sense was true. The din of falling rock was muted in the shadow, though its thunder was only yards from where they stood. When she cupped his face in her hands and spoke, her whispers were quite audible, as were his.
"I've missed you," she said.
There was a welcome warmth in her voice after the days of anguish and accusation he'd heard.
"I even dreamed about you."
"Tell me," he murmured, his lips close to hers.
"Later, maybe,"
she said, kissing him again.
"I've so much to tell you."
"Likewise," Gentle said.
"We should find ourselves somewhere safer than this," she said.
"We're out of harm's way here," Gentle said.
"Yes, but for how long?"
The scale of the demolition was increasing, its violence out of all proportion to the force Gentle had unleashed, as though the pivot had taken the Pneuma's power and magnified it. Perhaps it knew, how could it not, that the man it had been in thrall to had gone and was now about the business of shrugging off the prison Sartori had raised around it. Judging by the size of the slabs falling all around, the process would not take long. They were monumental, their impact sufficient to open cracks in the floor of the tower, the sight of which brought a cry of alarm from Jude.
"Oh, God! Quasar!" she said.
"What about her?"
"She's down there,"
Jude said, staring at the gaping ground.
"There's a chamber below this. She's in it."
"She'll be out of there by now."
"No, she's high on Crouchy. We have to get down there."
She left Gentle's side and crossed to the edge of their shelter. But before she could make a dash for the open door, a new fall of rubble and dust obliterated the way ahead. It wasn't simply blocks of the tower that were falling now, Gentle saw. There were vast shards of the pivot itself in this hail. What was it doing? Destroying itself or shedding skins to uncover its core? Whichever, their place in the shadow was more precarious by the second. The cracks underfoot were already a foot wide and widening, the hovering monolith above them shuddering as if it was about to give up the effort of suspension and drop. They had no choice but to brave the rockfall. He went to join Jude, searching his wits for a means to survival, and picturing Chica Jacquin at the erasure, his hands high to ward off the detritus dropped by the storm. Could he do the same? Not giving himself pause to doubt, he lifted his hands above his head as he'd seen the monk do, palms up, and stepped out of the pivot's shadow. One heavenward glance confirmed both the pivot's shedding and the scale of his jeopardy. Though the dust was thick, he could see that the monolith was sloughing off scales of stone, the pieces large enough to smash them both to pulp, but his defence held. The slabs shattered 2 or 3 feet above his naked head, their smithereens dropping like a fleeting vault around him. He felt the impact, nevertheless, as a succession of jolts through his wrists, arms, and shoulders, and knew he lacked the strength to preserve the fate for more than a few seconds. Jude had already grasped the method in his madness, however, and stepped from the shadow to join him beneath this flimsy shield. There were perhaps 10 paces between where they stood and the safety of the door. "Guide me," he told her, unwilling to take his eyes off the rain for fear his concentration slip and the fate lose its potency. Jude slipped her arm around his waist and navigated for them both, telling him where to step to find clear ground, and warning him when the path was so heavily strewn they were obliged to stumble over stone. It was a tortuous business, and Gentle's upturned hands were steadily beaten down until they were barely above his head. But the fate held to the door, and they slid through it together with the pivot and its prison, throwing down such a hail of debris that neither was now visible. Then Jude was off at speed down the murky stairs. The walls were shaking and laced with cracks as the demolition above took its toll below, but they negotiated both the trembling passageway and the second flight of stairs down to the lower level unharmed. Gentle was startled at the sight and sound of Concupiscentia, who was screeching in the passageway like a terrified ape, unwilling to go in search of her mistress. Jude had no such qualms. She'd already thrown open the door and was heading down an incline into a lamp-lit chamber beyond, calling Quasar's name to stir her from her stupor. Gentle followed, but was slowed by the cacophony that greeted him, a mingling of manic whispers and the din of capitulation from above. By the time he reached the room itself, Jude had bullied her sister to her feet. There were substantial cracks in the ceiling and a constant drizzle of dust, but Quasar seemed indifferent to the hazard.
"I said you'd come back," she said. "Didn't I? Didn't I say you'd come back? Do you want to kiss me? Please kiss me, sister."
"What's she talking about?" Gentle asked. The sound of his voice brought a cry from the woman. She flung herself out of Jude's arms.
"What have you done?"
she yelled.
"Why did you bring him here?"
"He's come to help us," Jude replied.
Quasar spat in Gentle's direction.
"Leave me alone," she screeched. "Haven't you done enough? Now you want to take my sister from me. You bastard, I won't let you. We'll die before you touch her."
She reached for Jude, sobbing in panic.
"Sister! Sister!"
"Don't be frightened," Jude said. "He's a friend."
She looked at Gentle.
"Reassure her," she begged him. "Tell her who you are so we can get out of here."
"I'm afraid she already knows," Gentle replied. Jude was mouthing the word, "What?" when Quasar's panic boiled up again.
"Sartori!"
she screeched, her denunciation echoing around the room.
"He's Sartori, sister! Sartori!"
Gentle raised his hands in mock surrender, backing away from the woman. "I'm not going to touch you," he said. "Tell her, Jude, I don't want to hurt her." But Quasar was in the throes of another outburst.
"Stay with me, sister,"
she said, grabbing hold of Jude.
"He can't kill us both." "You can't stay in here," Jude said. "I'm not going out," Quasar said. "He's got soldiers out there. Rosengarten, that's who he's got, and his torturers." "It's safer out there than it is in here," Jude said, casting her eyes up at the roof.
Several carbuncles had appeared in it, oozing debris.
"We have to be quick."
Still she refused, putting her hand up to Jude's face and stroking her cheek with her clammy palm. Short, nervy strokes.
"We'll stay here together," she said. "Mouth to mouth, mind to mind." "We can't," Jude told her, speaking as calmly as circumstance allowed. "I don't want to be buried alive, and neither do you." "If we die, we die," said Quasar. "I don't want him touching me again. Do you hear?" "I know. I understand. Not ever. Not ever." "He won't," Jude said, laying her own hand over Quasar's, which was still stroking her face.
She laced her fingers through those of her sister and locked them.
"He's gone," she said. "He won't be coming near either of us again."
Gentle had indeed retreated as far as the passageway, but even though Jude waved him away, he refused to go any further. He'd had too many reunions cut short to risk letting her out of his sight.
"Are you certain he's gone?" "I'm certain. He could still be waiting outside for us." "No, sister. He was afraid for his life. He's fled."
Quasar grinned at this.
"He was afraid?" she said. "Terrified. Didn't I tell you? They're all the same. They talk like heroes, but there's piss in their veins."
She began to laugh out loud, as careless now as she'd been in terror moments before.
"We'll go back to my bedroom," she said when the outburst subsided, "and sleep for a while." "Whatever you want to do," Jude said, "but let's do it soon."
Still chuckling to herself, Quasar allowed Jude to lift her up and escort her towards the door. They had covered maybe half that distance, Gentle standing aside to let them pass, when one of the carbuncles in the ceiling burst and threw down a rain of wreckage from the tower above. Gentle saw Jude struck and felled by a chunk of stone. Then the chamber filled with an almost viscous dust that blotted out both sisters in an instant. With his only point of reference, the lamp, the flame of which was just visible through the dirt, he headed into the fog to fetch her, as a thundering from above announced a further escalation of the tower's collapse. There was no time for protective fates or for keeping his silence. If he failed to find her in the next few seconds, they'd all be buried. He started to yell her name through the rising roar, and hearing her call back to him, followed her voice to where she was lying, half buried beneath a cairn of rubble.
"There's time," he said to her as he began to dig. "There's time. We can make it out."
With her arms unpinned, she began to speed her own excavation, hauling herself up out of the debris and locking her arms around Gentle's neck. He started to stand, pulling her free of the remaining rocks, but as he did so another commotion began, louder than anything that had preceded it. This was not the din of destruction, but a shriek of white fury. The dust above their heads parted and Quasar appeared, floating inches from the fissured ceiling. Jude had seen this transformation before. Ribbons of flesh unfurled from her sister's back and bearing her up. But Gentle had not. He gaped at the apparition, distracted from thoughts of escape.
"She's mine!"
Quasar yelled, swooping towards them with the same sightless but unerring accuracy she'd possessed in more intimate moments, her arms outstretched, her fingers ready to twist the abductor's head from his neck. But Jude was quick. She stepped in front of Gentle, calling Quasar's name. The woman's swoop faltered, the hungry hands inches from her sister's upturned face.
"I don't belong to you,"
she yelled back at Quasar.
"I don't belong to anybody, hear me?"
Quasar threw back her head and loosed a howl of rage at this. It was her undoing. The ceiling shuddered and abandoned its duty at her din, collapsing beneath the weight of rubble heaped behind it. There was, Jude thought, time for Quasar to escape the consequences of her cry. She'd seen the woman move like lightning at Pale Hill when she had the will to do so. But that will had gone. Face to the killing dirt, she let the debris rain upon her, inviting it with her unbroken cry, which didn't become alarm or plea, but remained a solid howl of fury until the rocks broke and buried her. It wasn't quick. She went on calling down destruction as Gentle took Jude's hand and hauled her away from the spot. He'd lost all sense of direction in the chaos, and had it not been for the screeching of concupiscentia in the passageway beyond, they'd never have made it to the door. But make it they did, emerging with half their senses deadened by dust. Quasar's death cry had ceased by now, but the roar behind them was louder than ever and drove them from the door as the canker spread across the roof of the corridor. They outran it, however, concupiscentia giving up her keening when she knew her mistress was lost and overtaking them, fleeing to some sanctuary where she could raise a song of lamentation. Jude and Gentle ran until they were out from under any stone, roof, arch, or vault that might collapse upon them, into a courtyard full of bees feasting on bushes that had chosen that day of all days to blossom. Only then did they put their arms around each other again, each sobbing for private griefs and gratitudes, while the ground shook under them to the din of the demolition they'd escaped. 3. In fact, the ground didn't stop reverberating until they were well outside the walls of the palace and wandering in the ruins of Isordarex. At Jude's suggestion, they made their way back at all speed to Peckable's house, where, she explained to Gentle, there was a well-used route between this dominion and the Fifth. He put up no resistance to this. Though he hadn't exhausted Sartori's hiding places by any means, could he ever, when the palace was so vast? He had exhausted his limbs, his wits, and his will. If his other was still here in Isordarex, he posed very little threat. It was the Fifth that needed to be defended against him, the Fifth which had forgotten magic and could so easily be his victim. Though the streets of many Casperates were little more than bloody valleys between rubble mountains, there were sufficient landmarks for Jude to trace her way back towards the district where Peckable's house had stood. There was no certainty, of course, that it would still be standing after a day and night of cataclysm, but if they had to dig to reach the cellar, so be it. They were silent for the first mile or so of the trek, but then they began to talk, beginning, inevitably, with an explanation from Gentle as to why Quasar, hearing his voice, had taken him for her husband. He prefaced his account with a caveat that he wouldn't mire it in apology or justification, but would tell it simply, like some grim fable. Then he went on to do precisely that, but the telling, for all its clarity, contained one significant distortion. When he described his encounter with the Autarch, he drew in Jude's mind the portrait of a man to whom he bore only a rudimentary resemblance, a man so steeped in evil that his flesh had been corrupted by his crimes. She didn't question this description, but pictured an individual whose inhumanity seeped from every pore, a monster whose very presence would have induced nausea. Once he'd unravelled the story of his doubling, she began to supply details of her own. Some were culled from dreams, some from clues she'd had from Quasar, yet others from Oscar Godolphin. His entrance into the account brought with it a fresh cycle of revelations. She started to tell Gentle about her romance with Oscar, which in turn led on to the subject of Dowd, living and dying, thence to Clara Leash and the Tabula Rasa.
"They're going to make it very dangerous for you back in London," she told him,
having related what little she knew about the purges they'd undertaken in the name of Roxburgh's edicts.
"They won't have the slightest compunction about murdering you, once they know who you are."
"Let them try," Gentle said flatly. "Whatever they want to throw at me, I'm ready. I've got work to do, and they're not going to stop me."
"Where will you start?"
"In Clerkenwell. I had a house in Gamut Street. Pi says it's still standing. My life's there, ready for the remembering. We both need the past back, Jude."
"Where do I get mine from?"
she wondered aloud. "From me and from Godolphin."
"Thanks for the offer, but I'd like a less partial source. I've lost Clara and now Quasar. I'll have to start looking."
She thought of Celestine as she spoke, lying in darkness beneath the Tabula Rasa's tower. "Have you got somebody in mind?" Gentle asked.
"Maybe,"
she said, as reluctant as ever to share that secret. He caught the whiff of evasion. "I'm going to need help, Jude," he said. "I hope, whatever's been between us in the past, good and bad, we can find some way to work together that'll benefit us both." A welcome sentiment, but not one she was willing to open her heart for. She simply said,
"Let's hope so,"
and left it at that. He didn't press the issue, but turned the conversation to lighter matters. "What was the dream you had?" he asked her. She looked confounded for a moment. "You said you had a dream about me, remember?"
"Oh, yes," she replied. "It was nothing, really. Past history."
When they reached Peckable's house, it was still intact, though several others in the street had been reduced to blackened rubble by missiles or arsonists. The door stood open and the interior had been comprehensively looted, down to the tulips and the vase on the dining room table. There was no sign of bloodshed, however, except those scabby stains Dowd had left when he'd first arrived, so she presumed that Hoi Polloi and her father had escaped unharmed. The signs of frantic thieving did not extend to the cellar. Here, though the shelves had been cleared of the icons, talismans, and idols, the removal had been made calmly and systematically. There was not a rosary remaining, or any sign that the thieves had broken a single charm. The only relic of the cellar's life as a trove was set in the floor, the ring of stones that echoed that of the retreat.
"This is where we arrived," Jude said.
Gentle stared down at the design in the floor.
"What is it?"
he said.
"What does it mean?"
"I don't know. Does it matter?"
"As long as it gets us back to the fifth."
"We've got to be careful from now on," Gentle replied. "Everything's connected. It's all one system. Until we understand our place in the pecking order, we're vulnerable." One system. She'd speculated on that possibility in the room beneath the tower, the Imagicka as a single, infinitely elaborate pattern of transformation. But just as there were times for such musings, so there were also times for action. And she had no patience with Gentle's anxieties now.
"If you know another way out of here," she said, "let's take it. But this is the only way I know. Godolphin used it for years, and it never harmed him, till Dowd screwed it up."
Gentle had gone down on his haunches and was laying his fingers on the stones that bound the mosaic.
"Circles are so powerful," he said.
"Are we going to use it or not?"
He shrugged.
"I don't have a better way," he said, still reluctant. "Do we just step inside?"
"That's all."
He rose. She laid her hand on his shoulder and he reached up to clasp it.
"We have to hold tight," she said. "I only got a glimpse of the inn over, but I wouldn't want to get lost there."
"We won't get lost," he said, and stepped into the circle.
She was with him a heartbeat later, and already the express was getting up steam. The solid cellar walls and empty shelves began to blur. The forms of their translated selves began to move in their flash. The sensation of passage awoke in Gentle memories of the outward journey when Pai O'Pa had stood beside him where Jude was now. Remembering, he felt a stab of inconsolable loss. There were so many people he'd encountered in these dominions whom he'd never set eyes on again. Some like Efreet Splendid and his mother, Niketomas and Huzar because they were dead. Others like Athanasius because the crimes Sartori had committed were his crimes now, and whatever good he hoped to do in the future would never be enough to expunge them. The hurt of these losses was of course negligible, beside the greater grief he'd sustained at the Erasure. But he'd not dared dwell too much upon that, for fear it incapacitated him. Now, however, he thought of it, and the tears started to flow, washing the last glimpse of Peckable's cellar away before the mosaic had removed the travellers from it. Paradoxically, had he been leaving alone, the despair might not have cut so deep. But as Pai had been fond of saying, there was only ever room for three players in any drama. And the woman in the flux beside him, her glyph burning through his tears, would from this moment on remind him that he had departed his Order X with one of those three left behind. Chapter 7 1 157 days after beginning his journey across the reconciled dominions, Gentle once again set foot on the soil of England. Though it wasn't yet the middle of June, spring had arrived prematurely, and the season on its heels was at its height. Flowers not due to blossom for another month were already blowsy and heavy-headed with seeds. Bird and insect life abounded, as species that normally appeared months apart flourished simultaneously. This summer's dawns were announced not with choruses, but with full-throated choirs. By midday the skies from coast to coast were cloudy with feeding millions, the wheels slowing through the afternoon, until by dusk the din had become a music, sated and survivors alike giving thanks for the day, so rich it lulled even the crazy into remedial sleep. If a reconciliation could indeed be planned and achieved in the little time before midsummer, then it would be burgeoning country that the rest of the Imagica would greet, an England of bountiful harvests spread beneath a melodious heaven. It was full of music now, as Gentle wandered from the retreat, out across the dappled grass, to the perimeter of the copse. The parkland was familiar to him, though its lovingly tended arbours were jungles now, and its lawns were felt. "This is Joshua's place, isn't it?" he said to Jude. "Which way's the house?" She pointed across a wilderness of gilded grass. The roof of the mansion was barely visible above the surf of fronds and butterflies. "The very first time I saw you was in that house," he told her. "I remember. Joshua called you down the stairs. He had a pet name you despised. Peach Blossom, was it? Something like that. As soon as I set eyes on you..."
"It wasn't me," Jude said, halting this romantic reverie. "It was Quasar."
"Whatever she was then, you are now."
"I doubt that. It was a long time ago, Gentle. The house is in ruins, and there's only one Godolphin left. History isn't going to repeat itself. I don't want it to. I don't want to be anybody's object."
He acknowledged the warning in these words with an almost formal statement of intent. "Whatever I did that caused you or anybody else harm," he said, "I want to make good. Whether I did it because I was in love or because I was a maestro and I thought I was above common decency, I'm here to heal the hurt. I want reconciliation, Jude. Between us, between the dominions. Between the living and the dead, if I can do it."
"That's a hell of an ambition."
"The way I see it, I've been given a second chance. Most people don't get that." His plain sincerity mellowed her.
"Do you want to wander to the house, for old time's sake?" she asked him.
"Not unless you do."
"No, thanks. I had my little fit of déjà vu when I convinced Charlie to bring me here."
Gentle had, of course, told her about his encounter with Esterbrook in the Dirthers' tents, and about the man's subsequent demise. She'd been unmoved.
"He was a difficult old bugger, you know," she now remarked.
I must have known in my gut he was a Godolphin, or I'd never have put up with his damn fool games.
I think he was changed by the end, Gentle said. Maybe you'd have liked him a little more.
You've changed too, she said, as they started to wander towards the gate. People are going to be asking a lot of questions, Gentle, like, where have you been and what have you been doing?
Why does anybody even have to know I'm back? He said. I never meant that much to any of them. Except Taylor, and he's gone.
Clem too.
Maybe.
It's your choice, she said. But when you've got so many enemies, you may need some of your friends.
I'd prefer to stay invisible, he told her. That way nobody sees me, enemies or friends. As the bounding wall came in sight, the skies changed with almost eerie haste. The few fluffy clouds that minutes before had been drifting in the blue, now congregating into a lowering bank that first shed a light drizzle, and a minute later was bursting like a dam. The downpour had its advantages, however, sluicing from their clothes, hair, and skin all trace of Isordorexian dust. By the time they'd clambered through the mesh of timbers and convolvulus around the gate and trudged along the muddied road to the village, there to take shelter in the post office, they could have passed for two tourists, one with a somewhat bizarre taste in hiking clothes, who'd strayed too far from the beaten track and needed help to find their way home. 2. Though neither of them had any valid currency in their pockets, Jude was quick to persuade one or two lads who stopped in the post office to drive them back into London, promising a healthy fee at the other end if he did so. The storm worsened as they travelled, but Gentle rolled down the window in the back and stared at the passing panorama of an England he hadn't seen for half a year, content to let the rain soak him all over again. Jude was meanwhile left to endure a monologue from their driver. He had a mutinous palate which rendered every third word virtually unintelligible, but the gist of his chatter was plain enough. It was the opinion of every weather watcher he knew, he said, and these were folk who lived by the land and had ways of predicting floods and droughts no fancy-talking meteorologist ever had, that the country was in for a disastrous summer.
"We'll either be cooked or drowned," he said,
prophesying months of monsoons and heat waves. She'd heard talk like this before, of course. The weather was an English obsession, but having come from the ruins of Isordorex, with the burning eye of the comet overhead and the air stinking of death, the youth's casually apocalyptic chatter disturbed her. It was as if he was willing some cataclysm to overtake his little world, not comprehending for a moment what that implied. When he grew bored with predicting ruination, he started to ask her questions about where she and her friend had been coming from, or going to, when the storm had caught them. She saw no reason not to tell him they'd been at the estate, so she did so. Her reply earned her what studied disinterest had failed to achieve for 3/4 of an hour, his silence. He gave her a baleful look in the mirror and then turned on the radio, proving, if nothing else, that the shadow of the Godolphin family was sufficient to hush even a doomsayer. They travelled to the outskirts of London without further exchange, the youth only breaking the silence when he needed directions.
"Do you want to be dropped to the studio?" she asked Gentle.
He was slow to answer, but when he did, it was to reply that, yes, that's where he wanted to go. Jude furnished instructions to the driver and then turned her gaze back towards Gentle. He was still staring out the window, rain speckling his brow and cheeks like sweat, drops hanging off his nose, chin, and eyelashes. The smallest of smiles curled the corners of his mouth. Catching him unawares like this, she almost regretted her dismissal of his overtures at the estate. This face, for all that the mind behind it had done, was the face that had appeared to her while she slept in Quasar's bed. The dream lover whose imagined caresses had brought from her cries so loud her sister had heard them 2 rooms away. Certainly they could never again be the lovers who'd courted in the great house 2 centuries before, but their shared history marked them in ways they had yet to discover. And perhaps when those discoveries were all made, they'd find a way to put into flesh the deeds she'd dreamed in Quasar's bed. The rainstorm had preceded them to the city, unleashed its torrent, and moved off, so that by the time they reached the outskirts there was sufficient blue sky overhead to promise a warm, if glistening, evening. The traffic was still clogged, however, and the last 3 miles of the journey took almost as long as the previous 30. By the time they reached Gentle's studio, their driver, used to the quiet roads around the estate, was out of sympathy with the whole endeavour, and had several times broken his silence to curse the traffic and warn his passengers that he was going to require very considerable recompense for his troubles. Dude got out of the car along with Gentle, and on the studio step, out of the driver's earshot, asked him if he had enough money inside to pay the man. She would rather take a taxi from here, she said, than endure his company any longer. Gentle replied that if there was any cash in the studio, it certainly wouldn't be sufficient.
"It looks like I'm stuck with him, then," Jude said. "Never mind. Do you want me to come up with you? Have you got a key?"
"There'll be somebody in downstairs," he replied. "They've got a spare."
"Then I suppose this is it."
It was so pathetic, parting like this after all that had gone before.
"I'll ring you when we've both slept."
"The phone's probably been cut off."
"Then ring me from a box, huh? I won't be at Oscar's, I'll be at home."
The conversation might have gutted out there, but for his reply.
"Don't stay away from him on my account," he said.
"What do you mean by that?"
"Just that you've got your love affairs," he said.
"And what? You've got yours?"
"Not exactly."
"What then?"
"I mean, not exactly love affairs." He shook his head. "Never mind, we'll talk about it some other time."
"No,"
Jude told him, taking his arm as he tried to turn from her.
"We'll talk about it now."
Gentle sighed wearily.
"Look, it doesn't matter," he said.
"If it doesn't matter, just tell me."
He hesitated for several seconds. Then he said,
"I got married."
"Did you indeed?"
she said, with feigned lightness.
"And who's the lucky girl? Not the kid you were talking about?"
"Bizarre? Good God, no."
He paused for a tiny time, frowning deeply.
"Go on," she said. "Spit it out."
"I married Pio Pa."
Her first impulse was to laugh. The thought was absurd. But before the sound escaped her, she caught the frown on his face and revulsion overtook laughter. This was no joke. He'd married the assassin, the sexless thing who was a function of its lover's every desire. And why was she so stunned? When Oscar had described the species to her, hadn't she herself remarked that it was Gentle's idea of paradise?
"That's some secret," she said.
"I would have told you about it sooner or later."
Now she allowed herself a little laughter, soft and sour.
"Back there, you almost had me believing there was something between us."
"That's because there was," he replied, "because there always will be."
"Why should that matter to you now?"
"I have to hold on to a little of what I was, what I dreamed."
"And what did you dream?"
"That the three of us..."
He stopped, sighing. Then,
"that the three of us would find some way to be together."
He wasn't looking at her, but at the empty ground between them, where he clearly wanted his beloved Pi to stand.
"The mischief would have learned to love you," he said.
"I don't want to hear this," she snapped.
"It would have been anything you desired. Anything."
"Stop," she told him. "Just stop."
He shrugged.
"It's all right," he said. "Pi's dead, and we're going our different ways. It was just some stupid dream I had. I thought you'd want to know it, that's all."
"I don't want anything from you," she replied coldly. "You can keep your lunacies to yourself from now on."
She'd long since let go of his arm, leaving him to retreat up the steps, but he didn't go. He simply stood watching her, squinting like a drunkard trying to hook one thought to another. It was she who retreated, shaking her head as she turned her back on him, and crossed the puddled pavement to the car. Once in, the door slammed, she told the driver to get going, and the car sped from the curb. On the step, Gentle watched the corner where the car turned long after the vehicle had gone from sight, as though some words of peace might yet come to his lips and be carried from them to call her back. But he was out of persuasions. Though he'd returned to his place as a reconciler, he knew he'd here opened a wound he lacked the gift to heal, at least until he'd slept and recovered his faculties.
3.
45 minutes after she'd left Gentle on his doorstep, Jude was throwing open the windows of her house to let in the late afternoon sun and some fresh air. The journey from the studio had passed with her scarcely being aware of the fact. So stunned had she been by Gentle's revelation.
Married?
The thought was absurd, except that she couldn't find it in herself to be amused. Though it was now many weeks since she'd occupied the house, all but the hardiest of her plants had died from loneliness, and she'd forgotten how the percolator and the locks on the windows worked, it was still a place she felt at home in, and by the time she'd downed a couple of cups of coffee, showered and changed into some clean clothes, the dominion from which she'd stepped only hours before was receding. In the presence of so many familiar sights and smells, the strangeness of Isordrex wasn't its strength, but its frailty. Without invitation, her mind had already drawn a line between the place she'd left and the one which she was now in, as solid as the division between a thing dreamt and a thing lived. No wonder Oscar had made a ritual of going up to his treasure room, she thought, and communing with his collection. It was a way of holding on to a perception that was under constant siege by the commonplace. With several jolts of coffee buzzing around her bloodstream, the fatigue she'd felt on the journey back into the city had disappeared, so she decided to use the evening to visit Oscar's house. She'd called him several times since she'd got back, but the fact that nobody had answered was not, she knew, proof of his absence or demise. He'd seldom picked up the telephone in the house, that duty had fallen to Dowd, and more than once he'd stated his abhorrence of the machines. In paradise, he'd once said, the common blessed use telegrams, and the saints have talking doves. All the telephones are down below. She left the house at 7 or so, caught a cab, and went to Regent's Park Road. She found the house securely locked, without so much as a window standing ajar, which on such a clement evening surely meant there was nobody home. Just to be sure, she went around to the rear of the house and peered in. At the sight of her, the three parrots Oscar kept in the back room rose from their perches in alarm. Nor did they settle, but squawked on in panic as she cupped her hands over her brow and peered in to see if their seed and water bowls were full. Though their perches were too far from the window for her to see, their level of agitation was enough to make her fear the worst. Oscar, she suspected, hadn't soothed their feathers in a long time. So where was he? Back at the estate, lying dead in the long grass? If so, it would be folly to go back there now and look for him, with darkness an hour away at most. Besides, when she thought back to her last glimpse of him, she was reasonably certain she'd seen him rising to his feet, framed against the door. He was robust, despite his excesses. She couldn't believe he was dead. In hiding, more like, concealing himself from the tabula rasa. With that thought in mind, she returned to the front door and scribbled an anonymous note, telling him she was alive and well, and slipped it into the letterbox. He'd know who'd penned it. Who else would write that the express had brought her home, safe and sound? A little after 10:30, she was preparing for bed when she heard somebody calling her name from the street. She went to the balcony and looked out to see Clem, standing on the pavement below, hollering for all he was worth. It was many months since they'd spoken, and her pleasure at the sight of him was tinged with guilt at her neglect. But from the relief in his voice at her appearance and the fervour of his hug, she knew he hadn't come to squeeze apologies out of her. He needed to tell her something extraordinary, he said, but before he did, she'd think he was crazy, he warned, he needed a drink. Could you get him a brandy? She could, and did. He fairly guzzled it, then said, "Where's Gentle?" The question and his demanding tone caught her off guard, and she floundered. Gentle wanted to be invisible, and furious as she was with him, she felt obliged to respect that wish. But Clem needed to know badly.
"He's been away, hasn't he?"
"Klein told me he tried calling, but the phone was cut off. Then he wrote Gentle a letter, and it was never answered."